Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific. 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper, and I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of www.patriotfamilies.com, a group of people who believe in everything upon which this nation was founded, and who always, always do their very best to see it succeed in all ways, moral, spiritual, economic, and, above all, in leadership. Our topic this evening, ladies and gentlemen, is the pursuit of excellence. Does it still matter? Our public schools have been under the control and the influence of the progressive elite for the past 30 years. They have done everything they can to subsume the idea of striving for excellence into a feel-good, false, compassionate philosophy that promotes mediocrity in the name of equality and makes sure everyone gets a trophy so they won't feel left out, and promotes people who do not have the academic skills to follow on to the next grade level so that they won't be left behind when their peers graduate from high school. We have lost the sight that our founders had of a future in which all citizens of this nation should have the opportunity to learn more than they knew yesterday. This pursuit of excellence, this desire to make tomorrow better than today, was the primary hope upon which this nation was founded. Our founding fathers believed that every human being should have the opportunity to rise as high and as far as his or her capabilities, talent, skills, work ethic would take them. We have lost sight of that goal, ladies and gentlemen, and we have dumbed down the population of our public schools in a devastating way. I was substituting today. I didn't happen to have any prisoners in my little academic jail. So I was covering an seventh grade English class. The assignment today was a scenario in which you are on board a small plane which crashes. The pilot and co-pilot are dead, and you and your companions are left stranded in Canada in January on a land covered with snow with zero temperatures during the day and dropping to 20 below at night. And the students were given a list of 12 things, which included a compass, a candy bar, 20 by 20 foot canvas tarp, some whiskey, and a few other things. And their job was to individually rank them in importance for survival from most important to least, 1 through 12. This exercise was to be done half the class independently, half the class time independently, making your order your list, and the students were to write 3 to 4 sentences explaining the reasons for the ranking. Then they were to work with a partner and come up with a list of rankings for the 12 items on their scenario that both partners could agree upon. It was a writing objective in using one's imagination, firmly reined in to the practical, and then collaborating with someone else and being persuasive enough and clear enough to work out a mutually acceptable list of priorities. These are skills that anybody needs in the real world, whether you're doing it in writing or you're doing it in reality. Those poor kids spent at least 10 minutes speculating on what kind of an airplane it was, how many people were in the group, and trying to get it done as soon as possible so they'd get a grade. I gave them some clues and some hints, like if they were given an example of how to justify and explain their choices at the bottom of the scenario page. The first period class, I had at least 4 of them who spent about 5 minutes arguing that they could use the example as their own work if they changed a period or a comma or a word. And I had to explain about 16 different times, no, this is an example. You can't copy it, eliminate a the, and then say it's your own word. That's called plagiarism, and it's illegal. One of the items on the list was a ball of steel wool, like you use a Brillo pad or an SOS pad that you use to scrape a dish. In every single class, 4 of them, each with about 15 to 20 students, there were at least 5 people who had no clue what this was. In each and every class, there were at least 5 to 7 people who didn't know what canvas was. I had at least 4 who wanted to know what a plastic-covered air map was. That was one of the items. These are seventh graders, ladies and gentlemen. My friend Linda says they'd die in the Canadian scenario, and yeah, they would. One of my boys at least had a very practical consideration. What if one of the items was a loaded pistol? He said, what if I just shoot everybody else and trek out on my own? I said, well, that might work if you could guarantee you wouldn't fall and hurt yourself and you wouldn't need somebody to help you out if that happened. It was a very interesting experience. Their focus was so far from understanding what the objective was. My friend Bill says Kansas is above Oklahoma. I wish at least one of them had connected it, Bill. Yeah, I would have had a wonderful time. But I doubt that any of them actually realize where Kansas is, let alone what canvas is. I can kind of understand not understanding what canvas is. If you go camping these days, your tent is nylon or some other polyester, and you don't see sailing ships that have anything except balloon spinnakers and nylon or a polyester sails. So I had to stop and explain by using the small model of a pirate ship, because the team, the teaching team that handles this class, are called the pirates, and explain to them what canvas was, and that a 20 by 20 tarp would be very heavy and wouldn't necessarily be waterproof. I had about at least 8 in each class who wanted to know if the one of the items was a lighter without fuel, and one girl asked me, would it turn on? I can understand that, too, because they're fairly uncommon, because obviously, you know, anybody who uses a lighter to light a cigarette or a cigar is an evil monster, so we don't want to go anywhere near that. But you would think that many of them, given that we live in a rural county, would have seen somebody light a pile of brush in the fall to burn it, or even light the barbecue, for heaven's sake. So I had to explain the concept of flint and steel and a tinderbox, and several of them asked me, they also had a jar of vegetable oil, and many of them asked me, well, will that burn? And I said, yes, if you get it hot enough, but you're probably not going to be able to get it lit with a spark from flint and steel. I also had to explain to them that the newspaper for each person, which was part of the 12 items, could not only be tinder for a fire, but it could be extra insulation. Another item was an extra pair of pants and an extra shirt for everybody on the plane. And the scenario explained that everyone on the plane was dressed for a business meeting, which meant dress shirt, tie, jacket, and dress shoes for the men, and either a dress pantsuit, dress slacks, dress jacket, and heels, or a skirt and heels for the women, if there were any in the party. They were not dressed for trekking 35 kilometers to the nearest town wearing high heels. And one girl actually said, well, you could take it off and walk in your stockings. Sure, honey, you walk through wilderness country in Canada in January in your stocking feet, and you won't have any feet left. The amazing ignorance of any world beyond their own. And these kids are studying, have studied American history for 2 years. They've studied times in which you didn't press a button to start your Wii or your microwave. But they have no concept, ladies and gentlemen, because no one has ever forced them out of their tiny little comfortable world that says, if I just do just enough, I'll pass, then I can go home and play my video games. Nobody has encouraged or demanded of them that they try to look beyond the next snack or the next video game or the next text on their phone. My friend Linda asked, aren't there any groups that do real camping like Girl Scouts? Well, there are. But generally, their camping is in a hut with wood floors and probably polyester, if not canvas, sides. And they go to a dining hall to eat. And if they do an overnight camp out with bedrolls, probably every parent would be suing the Girl Scouts of America for putting their delicate little darlings into the danger of being out in the wilderness a mile away from a telephone as cruel and unusual punishment. My friend Bill says that his father always hunted barefoot no matter the time of the year because he was Blackfoot Indian. And that's a great comment too, Bill, because it brought up something that I mentioned to the class. I just finished reading a book by Philip Meyer called The Sun. It is the saga of a family in Texas going back to the 1840s up to 2012. And the founder and patriarch of the family, who lived to be 100 years old, he was born in 1836 and died in 1936, was kidnapped by the Comanche and his family was killed when he was about 12 years old. And he lived with him for 3 years. So I cribbed a bit from the book. During his time with the Comanche, he is basically a slave until he gets on his hind legs and says, no, I'm a man, I won't do it. And then his captor and owner becomes his foster father. And his foster father, the Comanche chief, says to him, to the Comanche, a coward is a man who ever only thinks of himself. A brave man puts another first. And I use that to defuse the kill everybody and I'll survive and I don't care about anybody else. But the understanding that the world could be, their world could change drastically, that the way things are now is not the way they always have been, and that thinking might save your life just went flying over their heads by, like the geese going north or south. And it was absolute murder when they split up to work as partners. First of all, they cannot speak in anything less than a dull roar. So my chances of actually being heard if someone asked me for help were minimized because I spent a great deal of time raising my voice to almost shouting level to get everybody to tone it down enough so that I could answer the question that somebody asked me. I do not expect seventh graders, ladies and gentlemen, to be as well-read or as knowledgeable as I am. Good God, I'm 5-6 times their age. I'm supposed to know more than they do. One of the girls in one of the classes asked me, Mrs. Rowland, how come you know all this stuff? Because I was describing a travoy, which is the Indian version of a trailer, okay? And I said, well, it's because I'm 67 years old, I listen, and I read. And I said, you could know twice as much as I did when I was your age. All it takes is the effort. And she kind of looked baffled, like somehow or other I emerged from an egg yesterday with knowledge intact. When I was in school, we were there to learn things that we hadn't known before. She then asked me, well, did you go to college? And I said, yes. And I told her where I went and, you know, what degrees I'd earned and so on and so forth. And she said, you liked school. Like, my God, you like being poisoned. And I said, going to a place with a whole bunch of people who had 5, 10, 20 years more experience and knowledge than I did, and they were going to give it to me for free? You bet I liked it. I was going to turn up my nose at this smorgasbord of knowledge and say, no, thank you, not this child. And everybody in the class laughed. But I wanted them to understand the value of striving to be better, striving for excellence. And the kids in our school system do. There are families and children who do. Our junior beta club team from our school got back today from a two-day convention, a statewide convention for the Beta Clubs of America. This organization is for middle and high school students, and it focuses on excellence in leadership, academics, and service to one's community. Every year they have a statewide convention. And our team at this convention, they hadn't had anybody to sponsor it for the last 8 or 9 years, I guess, but they did this year. Our team did exceptionally well. We had a couple of seconds, two firsts, and honorable mentions across the board. And one of our eighth graders won an award for leadership excellence that is only given out to 25 students nationally. And our young man won it for our school. We were all incredibly proud of them. It was announced this morning over the PA system. I mentioned it in every class because those kids and their sponsors, the teachers and parents and community members who gave their time so these kids could succeed like this. The pursuit of excellence does matter, ladies and gentlemen, and that today's events, how well the Beta Club did, the fact that I caught the interest of four different classes of kids to make them think, tells me it's not dead. It's there. All it takes is the flint and steel to make a spark, and the bonfire that this nation was born from will flame again. But we can't pursue excellence, ladies and gentlemen, if we allow ourselves to believe the lies that come from the academic idiots who are trying to tell our children that to strive to be good at something makes you selfish and evil, and that you're going to hurt people's feelings if you're better at something than they are. We have the most ridiculous dichotomy in this nation. We praise athletic and entertainment stars to the skies and hold them up as, God forbid, role models for their talent or their popularity or their skill. And yet we look down our nose and promote mediocrity in academics and learning. Not everybody is born a basketball star, a football star, a great singer, a great actor, a great dancer. If you're born with the talent and the spark in those areas, it takes effort and learning to perfect that talent to the point that you can assume a position on the national stage. But we're not telling children this. We're telling them this is an easy path to glory, and all you got to do is shoot hoops every day when you get home from school, and you'll be rich. And then we can take all your money and give it to people who don't have any talent or skill or any work ethic, and then they'll be comfortable and see out what a great guy you are. My friend Linda mentioned the pursuit of happiness about Chris Gardner. And yes, I'm familiar with it, and I have mentioned it in classes. Also, the movie about Dr. Ben Carson. I want these children, these precious piles of tinder upon which I have to light a spark, to blaze as brightly as the stars, because they can. But they won't if we continue to follow and be led by the nose by a bunch of people who want to standardize mediocrity into a collective that doesn't even recognize excellence. Or if it does, vilifies it as selfish pride. There is nothing wrong with pride in one's accomplishments, ladies and gentlemen. It motivates all of us. We all want to feel proud of ourselves. We want to be proud of our children, proud of our mates, proud of our friends, because we can bask in the reflected glory. But that's not a selfish desire, ladies and gentlemen. It's a motivating force. We want to believe in ourselves. Our children want to believe in themselves, but they have to base it on real achievement, not feel-good candy bar grading. I was talking with one of the teachers with whom I work today. One of the four classes that I substituted for is a collaborative class. And in it, we have several students whose reading skills and learning skills are very poor. And yet the almighty, all-inclusive progressives say that collaborative education, mainstreaming, is so wonderful because it makes everybody feel good about themselves, that the kids with special needs are included, and the kids who don't need special help can learn compassion toward their fellows. Maybe at the age of 30, yeah, but 12? No. All that does is tell everybody who can learn that somebody who can't is going to be given preferential treatment. And the ones that can learn and who aren't stupid are going to say, well, then why the heck should I work my butt off for good grades? I had another teacher tell me the number of times she's been told to change grades to satisfy parents who think little Johnny deserves a B instead of the D he actually earned. And she said she used to get upset about it when she was fresh out because it was a lie. And she said, now all I can do is say, no, I won't do it, but you use your administrative executive power and you change it, and you put your name on the change. And she continues to try to teach those who are willing and able to learn. Is it any wonder, ladies and gentlemen, that so many excellent teachers are leaving the profession in droves? It shouldn't surprise you. Because what makes a good teacher is passion. And the burning desire to see children no more when they leave your class than they did when they walked in. I've said many times on this program that I am not a wealthy person. I do not have economic power or political power or any other kind of power over anyone or anything except myself and the way I interact with my students and my fellow living beings. All I have to give, ladies and gentlemen, is what I have learned and what I know via academic training, via reading, or via life experience. And I can no more sit at home and hoard those things than I could sprout wings and fly to the top of Mount Everest unaided. I grew up in a society that valued education. I grew up the daughter of members of the greatest generation, with a father who took a high school diploma and through taking every course he was offered and reading and learning and listening, rose from a draftsman to a project engineer in the aerospace industry. He didn't sit back at home and complain that the guys with engineering degrees made more money than he did, and why was that fair? He learned. My dad kept a little notebook into which he jotted interesting facts, and he still had about the 87th notebook when he passed away at the age of 80. He didn't stop learning. He didn't stop pursuing excellence. He taught himself how to do counted cross stitch when he was in his 60s and had to take early retirement. And his work is amazing. I've mentioned before, he could do counted cross stitch over single thread on a 22 threads per inch count cloth. Now stop and picture in your mind an inch and imagine that there are 22 threads in that 1 inch, and you are crossing over a single thread with your little X to make the design from a graph. I can't even see that fine work. But he was a creative, lifelong learner, and he taught his daughters to be the same. When I was 6, 7, and 8 years old and I was helping my mother in the kitchen with preparing dinner or cleaning up, we play the grammar game. She'd say, them people look funny. And I'd say, no, Mommy, it should be those people look funny. And she'd say, very good. the number of kids that I see who speak a poorer quality of English than a recent immigrant from China would disgust you. I have to explain in words of less than one syllable, if possible, by osmosis, to kids who have never learned how to diagram a sentence, what a coordinating conjunction is, and that it is preceded by a comma in a compound sentence. Because I got to go back and explain conjunction, coordinating, comma, preceded, and sentence. Because they haven't listened for the previous 5 or 6 years when somebody else told them what those words meant. It isn't the pursuit of excellence that doesn't matter, ladies and gentlemen. The pursuit of excellence always matters. What doesn't matter to progressives is anybody actually taking themselves truly seriously and understanding that you are going to succeed at some things, other things you are not going to succeed at because you don't have the physical capabilities to do them, and some things, in order to succeed at, you're going to have to work your delicate little derriere off, and that it's worth the work to do it. Our children are being systematically addicted to the easy button. Becoming addicted to a world in which effort means nothing and success is owed to you because you are here. My friend Linda asks, I wonder what type of value they place on themselves. Oh, astronomical. I will never forget, about 15 years ago, there was a worldwide survey done among, I believe it was high school students, in about 14 different developed countries. And one part of the survey was about how much do you believe in yourself, your self-esteem? Well, American students placed around third from the bottom in their mastery of the basic academic skills, but they were number one in self-esteem. And that was 15 years ago. And it's gotten worse. The number of times that I've had to explain to these kids that your right to freedom of speech is guaranteed by the Constitution, but there's no guaranteed right in the Constitution that people will like what you say, agree with you, or stand around and listen to you. They can't tell the difference between fact and opinion. And they have really been systematically taught, directly and subliminally, that what matters is to feel good about yourself and have as many friends on Facebook as possible. I mean, with a president who goes on YouTube comedy show to promote a nationalized health plan to catch the attention of these same kids who went through public school 5 or 6 years ago, and even they aren't buying it, it should tell you, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't already know, what deep bucolic byproduct we're standing in. I don't expect adolescents, pubescent adolescents, to think above the waist for longer than about a minute and a half at a time, purely and simply because my life experience working with this age group has told me that that would be unrealistic, and if I do keep expecting it, I'll wind up in one of those interesting white coats that ties with your arms behind you, or your hands at least. My friend Linda says the attempt to sell this ridiculous, non-workable juggernaut that's going to beggar all of us to young people so that they can be beggared faster than those of us who are old enough to need medical care. It's the pie in the sky and peace on earth. I can give it to you if you just give up your right to choose. Unless, of course, it's the right to choose to kill an unborn baby because it's not convenient to have it. That one you get to keep. Less people to spread the wealth among. I had another interesting incident happen. On Tuesday, I was out sick yesterday with gastrointestinal difficulties, so I was not at school. But on Tuesday, I was substituting in a 7th grade life science class. And we were talking about natural selection. The idea that survival traits, genetic traits that enhance your ability to survive, are likely to become widespread in a species because if they let you survive, you'll live long enough to reproduce and your genetic survival trait will be passed on to more offspring so that they inevitably will outnumber those who do not have it. And we were going over genetic changes and variations within a species, and I used the example of the timber wolf and the red wolf. The timber wolf is larger, heavier of body because its prey is larger, and it needs to be able to leap up and bite the tendon, the back tendon of a deer, of an elk, or a moose's leg, so the animal will fall, and the pack can fall on it, tear out its throat, and eat dinner. And that the red wolf is a little smaller and more agile because their hunting territory and their prey are in coastland forests. So they need to be able to slip over and around and through bushes and trees, and they don't need to be as tall because deer are not as tall as moose. And one kid said, you know, Ms. Rowland, you're a really violent teacher. That's ooky. And I said, no, I'm not at all violent. I'm just honest. And he kind of said, oh. And I said, yes, that's the way predators chase down and eat their prey. I can't make it nicey-nice that they all sit down around a nice stump and have a cup of tea and talk to the deer first before they eat it. It just doesn't work that way. And I actually did have a couple of kids on the plane crash scenario says, what if somebody dies of frostbite? Can we eat him? And I said, well, you could, but you don't know what particular diseases he or she might have had in addition to the frostbite, so eating them might give you more problems than not. And we have a very strong taboo in our society that you don't eat human beings. Okay. Well, at least he was thinking, and he remembered something he learned about the Donner Party. So it really wasn't all bad. He was actually using his mind and his imagination to envision a scenario that would not occur in his normal we existence. The spark can still find tinder. My friend Linda says I handle them well because I'm used to them, and yeah, that's pretty much it. Maybe it's because in many ways I'm still about 13 myself, but I understand age group, and the reason I choose to work with them, and always have, is because they haven't closed their minds completely to the fact that adults actually know things. By the time they get to high school, they are into the late adolescent period where the only people who know anything are their peers. Teachers are all stupid. Adults are all stupid. But I got to learn this stuff so I can go to college and get a job, and then I can do what I want. So the arrogance is still there, but the cracks to reach in behind it have pretty much closed up, which is one of the reasons I prefer the middle schoolers. You can still insidiously sneak in through the cracks and get some values and some principles and some love of learning and humor and scenarios and acting ability to wake them up a little and find, and maybe 10 to 20% of them will start thinking outside the box and start wanting to know more. My friend Linda says in high school, where the hormones in high gear. Well, they're actually in high gear in middle school, too. It's just the physical capabilities and the opportunities are minimized. Middle schoolers don't drive their own cars. Yet. But bless their pointed little heads, these kids are starving for some real education, ladies and gentlemen. And by that, I don't mean necessarily how to build a fire in the wilderness, because 9 times out of 10, most of them will not wind up in the plane crash scenario. But they need to be taught how to think about possibilities that are not comfortable, safe, and secure. They need to broaden their view. They need to be able to get a glimmer, just a glimmer, of the size of the world and the variety of people in it. And you need to make the academic knowledge that they need relatable in some practical, pragmatic way to their current world. And when you teach them, you have to be the Sir Cedric Hardwick or the Sir Laurence Olivier of the teaching profession. Teachers are actors and actresses, ladies and gentlemen, and public speakers and mentors. We are on stage all day long. Because we are observed not only when we're at the front of the classroom, but when we're walking through the hallways. And anything and everything we say goes right back home to mom and dad. That's why when, like the one kid who said, "You're a violent teacher, Mrs. Rowland," that's why I said, "No, I am not at all violent, but I am honest." Because I'm pretty sure if I hadn't said that, he'd have gone home and told his mother that my substitute teacher was really gross and described, biting people's throats out and eating them. Because believe me, these kids would, okay? They also, bless their hearts, are too young to have any degree of self-control beyond 90% of the time actually knowing they need to use the bathroom. Self-control is a hard-won adult characteristic, ladies and gentlemen. But it doesn't just land on your head on your 21st birthday. It has to be taught. And it has to begin not when you're 18 and thrown out into the world on your own, if your parents can't afford you to send you to college or you can't find a student loan. It needs to be taught from babyhood on up, in small steps, because that is part of success in that pursuit of excellence. Yet our classrooms are promoting the lack of self-control with all of the individualized education plans and accommodations for children who cannot control their impulsivity. Well, doggone it, I know a really good way to control impulsivity. It's called expulsion if you disrupt my class one more time. We have a youngster in our school who is quite cherubic looking and a filthy-minded, nasty little monster who spends most of his time in class doing something gross from fondling himself to giving his fellow students the finger when the teacher's back is turned, or making explicit comments or nasty insults to other kids, and then the minute he gets caught, oh gee, walking up to the kids, say, gee, I'm sorry, I really shouldn't have said that. And of course, he's learned that that means that the kid he's been tormenting has got to accept his apology, and so he lies in wait for a day and starts it all over again. Well, this kid is going to wind up in one or all of three places: a hospital, a prison, or the morgue. Because one of these days, the he can't help it is going to turn into, you little piece of, you know what, I'm going to knock your block off, and it's going to happen. Because he's little. He's undersized for his age. And we've got several kids in his classes who are taller, way taller than I am, boys. And because our culture teaches our young men that you don't pick on somebody smaller than you, he gets by with it. And every time he gets hauled up to the principal's office, inevitably somebody says, well, he can't help it, it's his poor impulse control, it's in his IEP. Well, I personally do not give a rat's backside what's in his IEP. He does not have the right to create a zoo in a classroom in which maybe more than half of the kids actually want to learn what I have to teach. And no, I cannot stop the class and pander to his impulsivity control so that nobody else in class learns anything about fractions or natural selection or genetic theory while I babysit a toddler in a 12-year-old body. But this is what the all-inclusive, make everybody feel good because my son is in regular classes mantra has done. The free, appropriate public education mantra within the Department of Education federally and its interpretation of the Americans with Disabilities Act as it applies to education. That and that alone has been the biggest rock thrown at the pursuit of excellence. Because not only does it allow students who are a disruptive influence and damage the ability of other students to learn control of the classroom, it puts teachers in the impossible position of having to tailor the way they teach to that child and still meet the objective chronological standards that says everybody in his grade has to learn X, Y, and Z before they get out of it. When half of every class is spent dealing with this one obnoxious child. And please don't get me wrong, folks. I have dealt with this particular individual. He's a repeat offender in my jail, obviously. And every teacher who has dealt with him has become so frustrated because we have tried over and over and over to get him to change his behavior. But nobody ever will change a behavior until it becomes uncomfortable for them. And his behavior is not being made uncomfortable for him. It is being allowed to make everybody around him uncomfortable, and he sails away, happily smiling sweetly with an apology every time. And in this climate, how can we have even the pursuit of excellence, let alone the attainment of it? I find it ironically amusing that this all-inclusive, everybody feels good situation that's supposed to make us all love one another and have a kumbaya moment every 10 minutes has actually done more harm to the special needs kids than the separate special ed classes or self-contained ever did. Our kids are not in school solely to become members of a social group. Becoming members of a social group is a byproduct of intermingling with other children from different family backgrounds, different skill levels, different abilities, different personalities, and different characters. It's not the purpose of an academic education beyond kindergarten. Socialization skills are very important for everyone, but they are not the function of public education beyond kindergarten age. Kindergarten is about socialization. Play nicely with others. Take your nap when you're supposed to. Get used to the fact that blue is blue and green is green and red is red and not orange. Begin to understand the concept of number and that five things are more things than two things. Learning self-control, at least to the point that you don't constantly scream and run around when the teacher is trying to talk to you. That's socialization skills, and that's what you learn in kindergarten. My friend Doc, who's leaving the chat room, said, sincerity is not part of the apology of that kid, and he's right, it isn't. The kid's a doggone good actor, and because he has a sweet little cherubic face and a rosebud mouth, and he's blonde and cute, he's smart enough to use it. My own grandson pulled the same kind of behavior, but he has a mother who, when she found out that he was being loved out of his bad behavior with candy and time out, jerked him out of the school he was in and put him somewhere where there were actual behavioral codes that he had to abide by, or he had something uncomfortable happen to him. And you know what? His behavior improved about 1,000%. Because the inappropriate behaviors were now uncomfortable for him. You do not teach your puppy not to pee in the living room by petting him and telling him you understand he couldn't help it. And no, I am not saying that our children are dogs. But I am saying that raising a puppy and raising a child have a great many things in common. When you're teaching a puppy not to pee in the living room, you don't pick up a shotgun and shoot him when he does it either. He doesn't learn anything very much when he's lying there dead on your living room rug. You don't beat him until he's afraid of you any more than you shoot him with a shotgun. You teach. And because puppies do not understand spoken English other than tone of voice, usually that teaching involves a snack so that the puppy associates peeing in the living room with an uncomfortable sensation and associates peeing in the backyard where he's supposed to with a dog treat or a pet or a good boy from his pack leader. And I know there are people who will say I'm being simplistic and I'm treating children as if they were animals. Well, dang it, they are. So are we. Immature human beings are instinctual creatures, just like a puppy or a baby deer or a baby rabbit or a baby fox or a baby tarantula, for heaven's sake. Except we're mammals and not insects. You don't teach children the behavioral norms of their society by rewarding them for inappropriate behaviors or smothering one with hugs and kisses when they behave badly so that they'll still know they're loved. Well, no, they're not necessarily unloved, but they're not liked very much when they do those sorts of things. The pursuit of excellence, ladies and gentlemen, is not just about academic excellence, although we have fallen sadly from our former pinnacle of that. The pursuit of excellence is about character and virtue and a sense that I am responsible for my own words and deeds. The organizations to which we belonged when we were kids, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, various church groups, service groups, etc., 4-H, were always about personal responsibility as well as the skills they taught. There wasn't any, well, I can't help it. I really don't like tying knots. Okay, fine. Then you stay at this level of scouting until you get to the point where you like it enough to learn how to do it. Like the kid I had several weeks ago who doesn't like math, so he isn't obligated to learn it. It's hard, and he doesn't like it, so he just doesn't, no, you're not allowed to teach me that. This is the climate, ladies and gentlemen, that is going to produce the future voters and future elected officials of this nation. Is it any wonder that we have a spoiled, entitled victim who has used that status to gain the Oval Office? It shouldn't surprise you, because all of us have been subliminally taught through the media, entertainment, as well as news, that to succeed means to be like everybody else and to give away anything you have because other people will feel bad if you don't. Oh, and to my friend Nick in the chat room, please give my friend Yo my best and tell her she's always, always in my thoughts and prayers, as you are, Nick. We can't set aside a belief that seeking excellence is a proper and laudable goal, ladies and gentlemen, and expect to remain a viable power in the world, for good or evil. We cannot make mediocrity and feel good, everybody gets a trophy philosophy, the goal for our children in their schools. Even if you go beyond the academics and into the intramural sports, we don't have any problem with coaches urging their teams to win, and yet everybody oohs and ahs and seeps tears over, oh, well, the team let the other team make two or three goals so they didn't beat them too badly. Or the coaches wouldn't allow this team to compete anymore because they beat their opponents too badly. They were too good. Oh, my Lord. What is going to happen to us as a nation and as a species if this is the ultimate goal? The world of Harrison Bergeron. A world in which excellence must be forbidden because nobody can be better than anybody else at anything. Why is it okay to strive to be good at sports and unkind and cruel and selfish to strive to be good at academics? I am very grateful to work in the school in which I do work, ladies and gentlemen, because every year we have an assembly to honor those students who have achieved a perfect score on the state standards of learning, or who have gained honor roll status for an entire year. We still honor those who have striven for and achieved excellence. It still matters in my community. And that is another reason, ladies and gentlemen, why nationalizing our schools with Common Core is the death knell of this nation, because we need more communities like mine, not less. We need teachers like the ones I work with, who spend hours outside the schoolroom developing lesson plans and projects to try to spark that lifelong learner desire in every child they teach, and who are overloaded with paperwork and compliance to IEPs and meetings and parent-teacher conferences and phone calls, so that half of them are down sick 4 days a month out of sheer exhaustion. And God bless their hearts, they're still trying to raise their own kids on top of teaching yours. Everybody wants to blame teachers. Everybody wants a villain. We want the simple world of the television Western, where the good guys wore the white hats and the bad guys wore the black hats, and we could tell which ones were which. And we want the bad guys in the black hats to not be us. But we have been complacent, ladies and gentlemen. We have allowed this to happen because we have not spoken out. We have handed over the raising of our children to the state. And partly because the state has told us we're incompetent to do it ourselves. We can't discipline our children because that's abuse. We can't teach them moral and ethical values on a spiritual basis because that makes one religion more important than others in their eyes, and we can't have that. We can't teach them to try to win, because that'll make the loser feel bad. We have no ability to teach them self-control, so the school has to make allowances for them because they are obviously incapable of learning self-control. Or they need a teacher to teach them self-control instead of math or science or English or history or civics or French or Spanish or German or chemistry. Our teachers in the main, ladies and gentlemen, are strivers for excellence. It's what they do. What we do. We want your children to succeed. Not for us, but for them. It's why we do a thankless job. We're kind of used to it being thankless. My friend California Living says Obama wants us teachers to be moral leaders and to succeed in life. Okay. It would be nice if you would give us something in which we had at least a shot at success and not a ridiculous, impossible task mandated by the federal and state government to turn every child into a carbon copy of every other child so we'll all be happy together. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, too many people in power and in love with power have found that a life of ease and comfort and wealth, which even the poorest among us have in comparison to other places on the earth, makes people eager to close their minds and their ears to truth, lest it disturb their comfort and their wealth and their pleasure. They have understood bread and circuses, as did Nero. The people are upset with you, my lord emperor. Well, give them more circuses and more bread, and then they'll like me again, and all will be well. The current administration and the current Congress are all about the bread and circuses. They're all about the give a man a fish, so he's my man, and I can make him do anything he wants to for that fish. We have allowed ourselves to see becoming a trained seal as a goal in life. And the roots of this idea go way back. It's why young people flock to ideologies like progressivism and Marxism and communism, because the honeyed words about everybody should have the same as everybody else sound so good. But when it comes right down to it, those same young people who think it's so wonderful that we should spread the wealth kind of back up and say, wait a minute, when it's their wealth you want to spread. Like that survey in the California University, I think it was UCLA Berkeley, where everybody was, oh yes, you know, everybody should have, wealth should be redistributed. It's not fair for one person to be wealthier than another. And yet, no, I am not going to give up my A so the kid with the D can have a C. What are you talking about? I earned that. It's the optimism and idealism of youth being twisted and corrupted and turned in on itself, so that under the Comanche way, every one of them is a coward. It's easy to talk about thinking about others first. It's not quite so easy to do it. My friend Bill says it's the transference of loyalty from the parents to the collective, just as Hitler did, and he's quite correct. Young people are naive. They'll all tell you that they're not. They'll all tell you that you're the naive one because you don't know what it's like out there. And I always laugh because it's like, all right, where do you think we are? You think, you know, we just get wrapped up in a closet in a box and then they open it every morning when the bell rings? No. We are out there. And in here, too. And we got to try to juggle both of them. But this has been the state of the young since Socrates, for heaven's sake. And it's why the progressive promise to redesign humanity into a large, loving brotherhood of equal souls is as doomed to failure as it was in Socrates' time, or ancient Egypt, or ancient Babylon, or in the land of the Ur and Chaldees, or way back when Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal were competing for the same hunting territory. I am a firm believer in the obvious validity of natural selection, because those who have adaptive skills or survival skills or survival characteristics in their makeup, whether it is in their DNA or in their character, are the ones who are going to succeed and produce offspring, but not under progressive leadership, because the idea of producing offspring is a really bad one. Because if you're allowed to go out there and produce offspring, they might wind up to be individuals like you, and we can't have that because the collective needs cogs in the machine, ladies and gentlemen. We have to grow our own and make them into baby Borgs. My friend California Living says progressives hide their wealth. When they come to redistribution, just find a conservative, okay? They're the ones who are more likely to contribute to charity. And California Living says it's in nature, as a young individual, we want independence and freedom, and as we get older, we begin to see the value of the collective or the group as a backup to us when we can no longer go out adventuring. And it's the nature of people to be that way. But the wisdom of the grandparents is now stuck in Florida doing parasailing. We do not have the agrarian stay in one place from birth to death for 17 generations society that we developed in the 20th century. Technology, transportation, scientific innovations have made us way more mobile than we've ever been. It doesn't take 3 months in a wagon train to get from St. Louis to Sacramento anymore. And the idea that people as they age have value and wisdom and life experience upon which we can draw is just ridiculous. They're old. We need to put them somewhere in Florida so they won't bother us and they can play golf and talk to each other about the good old days and we can go out and do stuff. Because no old person has any sense, and they just talk about what it used to be like, and, you know, that's boring old stuff. They don't know what the world's like now. I always find it rather insulting when I see these commercials for cell phones and computers for feeble-minded old people like me. The assumption is that we can't learn anything anymore. We're so steeped in old-fashioned values and ideas like learning is a good thing, that we're incapable of learning anything new. Like, learning isn't important so long as you fit in. Again, don't strive for excellence. We'll dumb it down for you. Yes, it is a little scary, California Living, when Grandma starts talking to the make-believe person her imaginary friend she had as a kid. But then again, if you look at it from the right angle, maybe those conversations might be more fun for her grandchildren than discussing her medical situation or when she gets her next shot at the doctor. I can kind of understand talking to an imaginary friend. I used to do that all the time, and I still do. It's only when you get to the point that the imaginary friend is more real than everybody else about you that you need to have Grandma somewhere where she can't hurt herself. But unless she suffers from Alzheimer's or a physical disability that makes her unable to communicate or use the body parts necessary, Grandma can learn how to use a computer and a cell phone and text things and take pictures and use apps. I do. Now, I might not be as quick at it as somebody who's 12 or 13 because I didn't grow up with it. But neither am I senile or stupid. And what I have learned through my life has been just that. I've learned it. I have a skill that's of value. My friend Bill has done the parasailing bit, but sorry, not me, Bill. I admire you. I think it's great, but an acrophobe like me, the last thing we want to do is be dangling from a sail above a very large body of water until somebody manages to tell us how the heck to get back down. My adventures tend to be mental rather than physical, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not quite as flexible physically as I was 40 years ago. Mentally, I am. In the sense that I can get my head around a new idea and make some kind of judgment about whether or not it makes better sense than an old one. But that's part of it, too. That denigration of and shoving off in a corner of those who have way more life experience and more living history in their little finger than the current power generation in their 40s could ever imagine. I don't claim to be the all-wise, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not Odin, and I'm definitely not the two ravens who hang around with him, thought and memory. But I am still capable of learning, and I enjoy it. And I see value in learning something new. Because in my job, I've had to learn how to use technology that was literally science fiction when I was the age of my students. And had I not been able to learn to use it, I wouldn't have a job. Because I was taught that learning and the pursuit of excellence were important, that they mattered, that my life was one long adventure of learning. And that's why you're sitting there bravely and patiently suffering through my monologue tonight. But I'll give you a break. We've got a caller on the line, and I think it's my friend Linda. Hello there.
Hi, it's me.
I thought it was you.
Enjoying your rant about the collective and the statism mentality that they are the philosopher kings and know so much better. Well, mm-hmm. And when we start looking at this common core nonsense, which I think that, number one, we should start hearkening back to the 10th Amendment real soon and get rid of this horrible, horrible idea, especially uh-huh. of nationalizing all of these things. Because 35-plus years of progressive education has produced what just, I can't remember whether it was yesterday or the day before, on the House floor, and that moronic Yale graduate, Sheila Jackson Lee, saying that the Constitution was 400 years old, which I believe that's about 6 years prior to the people landing on Plymouth Rock. I cannot understand, and nobody said anything. I mean,
I know. Nobody.
Nobody said anything. Oh, my
nobody
God.
Nobody even laughed. I would have been hysterical.
Oh, my
I really
God. I absolutely. It's just, you cannot, well, it's the same as that poor guy that thought Guam was going to capsize. I mean, and these people keep voting because they recognize the name. They have their heads in the sand nine times, uh-huh. you know, out of ten
and,
of their whole
and,
lives, except
and,
our, and
even,
then on voting day.
They're even more poorly educated than she is, too, Linda.
This is why you still have Boxer and Frankenfeinstein and the rest of them and Pelosi and Waters getting reelected time and time again, and you get the Upchuck Schmuck Schumers, and you get the Harry Reid. The man is one sentence away from a straitjacket, for God's sake.
Yes.
I've never seen anything, and they vote for this. Are they crazy?
Yes.
Oh, my God. And
crazy then, and stupid.
Then you had the other day, and that, well, actually it was a couple weeks ago, and this is what I talked about on my show a little bit, where Rick Perry was absolutely freaking livid, because the serpent that sometimes slithers around the Resolute desk was speaking in front of of the governors, both Republican and Democrat. What I said it yesterday, I said, they would have had to duct tape me to my chair. I would have flown across the room and throttled him. He said to these people, I don't trust you to do make decisions of your own state with regard to education and other matters. And then he said, he threatened them, and if I hear any pushback from you people on Washington spends too much money, you'll hear from me. That would have done it for me. That would have done it. Holy Christ. I don't even know how they contain themselves, Terry. I don't.
You said it earlier, Linda. The arrogance of, we were number one in self-esteem. In other words, I don't have to know anything. I'm wonderful. I run into this.
Exactly.
And that's what we have in the Oval Office and what we have on the floor of the House and the floor of the Senate.
Oh, my God.
And in state legislatures and governorships.
Yep, I know.
Yeah, it's appalling. We used to, as a nation, expect our leaders to be educated men and women. We used to respect their knowledge. We used to respect their character, or try to. Now
We used to have self-respect as well.
Yes. Now what so many people vote for is either a pretty face or gimme, gimme, gimme. Okay, I promise I will.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the only time these people pay attention is when they're getting their Obama phones or their food stamps.
Exactly. They are eternally 12 years old. Mommy, I want these $300 sneakers because Susie has some. And it's not fair for Susie to have them and not me. Okay, honey, I'll run right out and sell your brother and buy them for you.
Well, and then when you're describing to us that you have to explain what a conjunction is, and then you have to explain what a sentence is, I mean, good grief.
This is in seventh grade.
Yeah, I know. When you are dealing with what I would go to most often, because this is the way you and I were brought up, you go to the dictionary if you really want to know what a word means and where the root of it is and why it was, coined into existence to begin with. And so, because words matter and ideas matter, and so... Mm-hmm. You know, this is where critical thinking comes in, and it's obvious that that's not, what do you call it? It's not popular anymore.
It is not an academic goal in our educational system, because
thinking. They want them completely dumbed down, like the poor saps crawling across the border so they can have permanent voters, and everybody's, the cog of the wheel, and they're getting their bread and circuses and their iPhones and, from Obama's stash. I mean, this is craziness. I mean, it's like, good grief. They've never read history. They don't know what the meaning of the word socialism is or real communism or anything else, or fascism for that matter. They can't connect dots. And it's like, holy smoke.
Yep.
It's like, no wonder the hackles don't come up on the backs of their necks. They're ignorant. And it's sad because
because you cannot keep a people subjugated unless you keep them ignorant and afraid.
Yep.
And that whole, you're going to hear from me. You're going to hear from me if you don't do what I tell you.
Oh.
It is
I told you I would have. I'd have been in jail. I would have been in jail.
He's a pocket dictator in love with his own charm, which he totally lacks in my view.
He's
but that's
so sickening.
Just me.
And I do believe he's also, as far as his teleprompter, et cetera, and it's starting to show that he has, he's not that bright. And he can do certain tasks, that they want him to do. He can jump through hoops like a little trained dog. And Valerie Jarrett writes all that crap for him. And she's not even the highest one on the rung as far as the American left. But my book by David Horowitz is coming up after I read Rosa Curie's. And I will be speaking from that on my show as well, because that's going to probably enlighten me a lot. I tell you, this is why I'm so glad you do what you do and you go on the air, and we do what we do and we go on the air and we go to community meetings and we try to educate people, because if we don't, who's going to, it's like, if not now, when, and if not me, who? I mean, so
that's pretty much
praise the Lord.
And it's... When you are a lifelong learner, Linda, as you are and as I am, you can no more sit silently back in a corner and watch everything go to hell in a handbasket and not say anything. You just can't do it, because your own moral compass, your own personal integrity, as someone who values knowledge, would not let you.
It's the way we're wired.
It's
like it's part of second nature to us. I know.
And I personally think that our genetic makeup is a survival trait, because those
Absolutely.
Who do not question and who do not learn are the ones who get run over by the very large, unfamiliar, big yellow thing with wheels.
Right.
Uh-huh. They stand in the middle
the first
of the road
to be thrown
and watch
under
it. You
yeah,
got
absolutely.
It, sweetie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because they're easy prey. Yeah. They're easy prey for the big bus.
I remember my David telling a story about this incredibly blonde girl that he went to high school with, who decided to go swimming in the middle of a very large boat channel and got cut into small pieces by propellers. And everybody was moaning and groaning about how sad it was and how pretty she was. And David was sitting in the back of the funeral parlor saying to himself, natural selection strikes again.
Oh, my God. Yeah, he was correct.
Yep.
You know, as callous as that may be, my father would have said the same thing.
Yeah, my David was a very bright man. I wouldn't have married him had he not been.
Exactly.
You know, spending 16 years with somebody who was stupid, you wouldn't have lasted 16 years.
Exactly.
But, you know, and it's not coldness. It's just realism. Understanding that, yes, it sounds nice to say, gee, wouldn't she have made a wonderful mother? But you think about what she's contributing to the gene pool. Thank you for telling. You know, it's
sad, yeah.
Yeah,
but you know, it is survival of the fittest, and in the wild, like the poor child who obviously had never been, you know, reading anything or been exposed to anything of nature, you are not a violent person. It's just a fact. Hello,
yeah, exactly.
The sunshine.
If his education about wild animals was limited to Bambi, he's in big trouble. And I loved Bambi.
Sure,
it was a delightful story. Felix Salten's book was excellent. The movie was very cute and sweet and lovely and everything else. But they don't live like that. And they don't talk. And they don't do cute little things. And the inability of parents to understand that when they protect their children to that extent, like in The King of Siam, they're protecting them out of all they own. Their future is being protected away from them because they can't differentiate fantasy and reality. They can't understand that their little, safe, comfortable world is going to go away when, if nothing else, mommy and daddy die, which they're likely to do before the kid. And you can't cripple a child that way in the name of love any more than binding a woman's feet to make her more beautiful and a better marriage proposal is good for her. You know?
Right.
I'm
going to let you wrap it up, and thank you so much for taking the call.
It's always a pleasure, sweetie. I look forward to that 760 area code popping up in the studio.
Thank you, and a great show as always. All right, hon. I'll see you in the chat room.
Thank you so much, darling. I'll be here. And as always, that's my beautiful California bird of paradise, Linda Sills, who works her delicate little derriere off speaking out the truth to anybody who will listen and even people who won't. That woman is amazing. Where she gets her energy, I don't know, but whatever source it comes from, I want it because I haven't got it. I am pushing it, doing this show every week, ladies and gentlemen. I know most of you are thinking, well, my God, it's not all that hard to talk for an hour and a half. But when you talk all day long, believe me, coming home and doing it again for an hour and a half does take a bit of chutzpah and courage. I want to thank you all for being here tonight, especially Linda and Rod and Bill and California Living and my friend Nick and the two guests who joined us tonight. Thanks for being here, and thank all of you out there listening. Please join us next Thursday right here on Blog Talk Radio at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time now for Patriot Education. Visit our website, www.patriot.com, and always remember that you are a teacher too, ladies and gentlemen. By what you do and what you say, you set the example. You are this nation, and you are its past, its present, and its future. Teach and learn as long as you have the delight of living. And as always, all my love to my greatest fan. Good night, everyone, and thank you again for being here. Blessed be.